There are different ways of thinking about the future. You can get all sci-fi. And seriously, a lot of what gets flagged in science fiction actually ends up happening. You can look to the past, not expecting to repeat it, but to learn from the patterns of history. You can look at signals in the present, demography, climate change, big movements of people from rural areas to urban, scientific advances, natural resource depletions. You can look at media and popular culture and how it's shaping attitudes and expectations, values, priorities, beliefs, and sometimes bigotry. And drawing on all of this, you can look at the rise and fall of nations. After all, no nation stays on top forever. When I started this podcast 2 years ago, the title Whose Century Is It? Was meant to be both playful and provocative. I'd spent about 15 years in China as an NPR and then PRI foreign correspondent on either side of the turn of the century. And I'd heard plenty of times, mostly in China, that if the 20th century was America's, the 21st would be China's. My feeling was, and is, it's not that simple. After all, a century is a long time. And sure, China is rising, absolutely. But so is India, which has a much younger workforce, while China's is aging. Also, just to throw in a wild card, by century's end, Nigeria is expected to have a larger population than the United States. If it can educate and empower that population and rein in corruption, Nigeria could be a force in the world too, perhaps along with other African nations. A lot can happen in a century. Just think about how the world looked in 1917, in the midst of World War I. In early September that year, people had no idea that a flu pandemic would start 4 months later that would infect 500 million people around the world and kill 50 to 100 million of them. People didn't know that the next month, in October, the Bolsheviks would win in Russia and create the Soviet Union, which would promote communism around the world, nurture the rise of the Communist Party in China, dominate Eastern Europe, and wage a Cold War against the United States that would shape most of the second half of the century. They didn't know, fighting this war to end all wars, that a second world war would come just 2 decades later, bringing with it the end of empire and the beginning of the American century, if you want to call it that. They certainly didn't know, probably couldn't fathom, that by the end of the century, hundreds of millions of people around the world would have computers, mobile phones, televisions, and cars, that they'd fly as easily as taking a train, that China would rise and would be seen by many people around the world as a rival world power to the United States, in some cases, preferred to the United States. Who knows what we can't see, can't even fathom, from where we sit now? Still, it's fun and useful to think about what we can see now that might matter going forward. That's been the project of this podcast. And this is the last episode of the first long season of Whose Century Is It? 2 years funded by the Henry Luce Foundation and co-produced with PRI's The World. The podcast will continue, still available wherever you get your podcasts. More on that at the end. For now, in this episode, I want to focus on another way we can think about the future, by looking at the generations that will shape it and how their influences and expectations are different from the generations that came before. In few places in the world is that difference more dramatic than in the generation coming of age in China today. This is Whose Century Is It? A podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. And I've been interested in China's younger generation for a while. I did a radio series a decade ago called Young China, which won an Overseas Press Club award. You can hear the whole thing on iTunes. Here's how it starts.
Hi, I'm Aaron Schachter. Welcome to this special podcast of The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. China's young generation is growing up in unprecedented times. It's riding a wave of prosperity and globalization. And this new generation of Chinese youth includes more only children than anywhere else on Earth. About 100 million of them have been born since China enacted its one-child policy 27 years ago. One child per family has become the norm in the cities, and parents have poured all their resources and hopes into these only children.
Which is great in one way, but it also sometimes means a lot of pressure on those kids. In the opening episode of this 2007 series, I mentioned a public awareness commercial the government was running on state-run TV. The boy sings, "I know you love me, but all this studying is too much for me to bear." Among the young Chinese I interviewed for this series was a then 20-year-old Beijinger named Lu Shan. She went by Lulu back then. She was an avid photographer, taking extra English lessons and writing a blog of her musings that had, at that point, 60,000 hits. She was aware of how lucky she was to be living the life she was living.
Actually, I think my mother really spoiled me a lot because my mother had a really tough childhood, you know. She wanted to give me something she haven't experienced, so she spoiled me a lot.
Lulu's mother was just 16 when she lost her own mother in the Tangshan earthquake of 1976. It killed 250,000 people. Lulu's mother began working full-time to put her younger brother through school. Her own schooling was over. Lulu says that's just how it was for girls then. A few days later, Lulu invites me to come over and meet her parents and her grandfather. He owns the apartment where they all live. It's a spacious place in a 1950s-era building. Outside, people walk their dogs on tree-lined streets. Inside, Lulu's mother brings us tea. She then disappears back into the kitchen as we sit down to talk with Lulu's grandfather, 75-year-old Lu Jianrong. I ask him how he feels when he looks at the opportunities his granddaughter has and compares them with his own during his childhood. He says, it's like the difference between heaven and earth. He grew up in a poor village with six brothers and sisters in an era of war and political turmoil. He says he was happy when the Communist Party came to power because it meant an end to war. But after that, he says, there were too many political movements, and it held back the economy. He's happy his granddaughter has grown up in a more prosperous China, but he's not so happy she's a girl. He says, all my grandchildren are girls. I would have liked to have had a grandson, but now it's impossible because of the one-child policy. It's lost for me, and I am not satisfied. He says this with Lulu sitting right across from him. She smiles and shrugs her shoulders like she's heard all this before. She is similarly good-natured when he grumbles that only children rely too much on their parents and don't help out around the house. Lulu freely admits this is true of her. But when I press her grandfather on whether he thinks there's anything good about the one-child generation, he admits there is.
Her generation has many advantages. For example, their views are broader, and it's easy for them to accept the new things. Not like my generation, whose brains are empty because we haven't seen a lot. We haven't seen foreigners when we were young. They have seen many new things. They are clever and fast in accepting what's new. That's the advantage of her generation.
Lulu's father, Lu Fuming, enters the room and joins the conversation. He's 48.
I think the biggest difference between my generation and my daughter's is that our lives were all about politics. We learned less from school. We trusted the nation's judgment of what was right and wrong. We had no thoughts of our own. The government gave us jobs, and we earned very little.
By the time I talked to Lu Fuming 10 years ago, he was doing just fine. He was working for a trade promotion agency, and the family was solidly middle class. When they looked to the future, they looked to the promise in Lulu, as so many other Chinese parents of only children have poured their hopes into that one young person in their family. China's one-child policy started under Deng Xiaoping in the early 80s, a time when China's economic growth was just taking off. That one-child generation has grown up in a peaceful, increasingly prosperous, and powerful China. That's radically different from what generations of Chinese had experienced. And this generation is radically different, too. It's more tech-savvy, sophisticated, and connected with the world through the internet, through television and films, through travel. It's also more urban. During this generation's lifetime, China's population has gone from being not quite 20% urban in 1980 to almost 60% urban now. At the same time, per capita GDP went from about $300 a year in 1980 to more than $8,000 now, and rising. Think of what that means in terms of the life you live, the people you meet, the expectations you have.
I think sense of possibility is the key factor.
This is Alec Ash, author of the book Wish Lanterns, Young Lives in New China. It's about the same generation I focused on in my series a decade ago, but a little older now, as young adults.
I was first drawn to write about this generation of young Chinese as it's my own generation.
How old are you?
I'm 31 now. I just graduated from university, and in the Olympic summer of 2008, I came to Beijing to learn Chinese in that transitional time when people were beginning to talk of China in a different way as a rising power, as the potential inheritor of the 21st century. I was most interested in my peer group, my language partners, friends who I made on and around campus, because in their stories I saw what I felt was the real transformation China was going through, which are these generational shifts. I blogged about young Chinese, I wrote some articles about them, and that germ grew into this book, Wish Lanterns, in which I follow the life stories of six young Chinese from all over the country and tell their stories from childhood up until the end of youth, if you will, which perhaps is where I am myself.
You figure the end of youth is 30, huh?
Well,
it all depends where you stand. I've got to tell you, being well on the other side of that.
Alec and I chatted in his Beijing home, down a narrow lane called a hutong in one of the older parts of town. The hutongs and the whole layout of Beijing were created under Kublai Khan 800 years ago. And while many of these picturesque old lanes have disappeared, the price paid for Beijing's approach to modern development and expansion, those that remain are dense with life and chatter and the age-old rhythms of community and culture. What better place to talk about how China's current generation may shape its future?
So you've been here during that hopeful time around the time of the Olympics and after with the global economic crisis, where China's leaders certainly thought, well, maybe this is our time. And then when Xi Jinping stepped in and the tone and approach to how people use the internet and the flow of ideas and everything started to change. How did those differences feel to you? And then also, you worked on this book over the course of 4 years. So you were following these six young people for 4 years. How were they absorbing this change?
Yes, I've been following six people for maybe sort of 2 or 3 years out of that 4 years in total working on the book. And of course, I stay in touch with them now and see how they're changing. And because of the pace of change in China, you have to react very, very quickly to what's happening around you. That means that dreams get compromised on very quickly. New ideas and new areas and career areas spurt up very quickly. Just to take one example, Lucifer, his original plan was to be a rock star. And when he realized that that wasn't working out, he thought, oh, maybe it's because I'm singing in English. So he sang in Chinese. When that didn't work out, he went on dating shows and talent shows. When that didn't work, he opened a cafe. Now he's opened a second one. He's constantly reinventing himself.
So that's one way this new generation is different. Not everyone reinvents themselves every few months, but there's at least a feeling for many that the possibility is there, or was there. As China's economic growth has slowed and President Xi Jinping has strengthened censorship online, banned many Western textbooks in schools, and even banned discussion on college campuses of what he apparently sees as such pernicious Western values as democracy, human rights, and rule of law, a generation that in childhood had a pretty open sense of possibility now faces something a bit different.
Now that the environment for free expression is less and has been clamped down on, some of those people who I was spending time with and slowly building trust and slowly getting to that point where I can ask them an honest question and get an honest reply on what they think of China. For example, one guy now my age called Da Hai, who was very vocal on Weibo, the Chinese version of Twitter, and had a very strong anti-authoritarian streak. He essentially gave up on that a couple of years back. Got him married. He has a car and a flat now. The supposed markers of having arrived in the middle class or having succeeded in some way. But you know, he tells me in as many words that he feels that he's compromised on that. So that's perhaps one change I've seen, a tightening of the space around you. But I don't think that's mutually exclusive from the sense of liberalizing ideas or a sense of forwards movement. I just think perhaps everyone acknowledges that now isn't the right time to be too vocal about those ideas.
But, I mean, do people feel like, hey, this is just how it goes? Sometimes things are looser, sometimes they're tighter. We're just rolling with it as it happens? Or is there some disappointment? Because this generation who's now in their late 20s, early 30s, they kind of grew up with a pretty open and opening internet and society.
Yes, I think there's a sense of disappointment. I also think there's a shorter perspective, both of the people I write about and of myself. I wasn't here in the 90s. They were still growing up in the 90s. So I think a sense of the cyclical nature of China, which I think you have a good perspective on, I think that's something which is perhaps missing. And the idea that give it another 5 years or 10 years and it might cycle back and open up again. But certainly online was a sea change when suddenly, beginning with blogs in the mid-2000s and then with the rise of Weibo in the early 2010s, and to a lesser extent now WeChat, although that's a closed system, it's essentially just talking with your friends, there was this great blooming of the space to talk and the space to express yourself and to hear what other people your age are interested in talking about, what they're thinking. There is general opinion that that space is less now. I think that's a pity, but I think people's attitudes and people's thoughts and values is something which you can't clamp down on, because we don't live in an Orwellian state or a sci-fi dystopia. And I think that those are expanding.
I'm going to push back a little bit on that, coming from a place where getting certain kinds of messages out repeatedly does seem to change the way people think about things, and in ways that I think distress a lot of us who live in the States dealing with the results. I think it's probably true with the generation you focused on. I'm wondering what will happen with the next generation down, because you know, this generation grew up with a relatively open China. Those who are 15 years younger are growing up with just sort of a different baseline of expectations and access to information. Mm-hmm. Do you think that they're already sort of benefiting from a society that's more sophisticated and open and kind of able to ride this out, or that this still could turn in a different way?
Well, of course, it depends which groups you're talking about. If you're talking about groups who come from the cities or would have the tech savvy to climb the Great Firewall and find out the information in a university that they were not told in school, as is the case of many, if not most, of the people who I talk to for the book, then I think that continues as ever and perhaps will only be more so as more and more Chinese go abroad for their education. But certainly in lower tier cities, certainly in the countryside, both of the generation I wrote about and today, there isn't that savvy, there isn't that willingness to go the extra mile to find out the full information. And we're a product of our environments. For those born in the 80s, the key aspect of their education came in 1991, which was the launch of what's called the Campaign for Patriotic Education, which had a number of direct effects, one of which was the introduction of political materials in school and in university, compulsory courses with titles like Deng Xiaoping, Economic Theory, and Mao Zedong Thought, which of course bored everyone stiff, but at the same time do inculcate a certain, perhaps, attitude towards socialism.
And this was, of course, introduced a couple of years after the Tiananmen crackdown with the very conscious ideal of, you know, we need to get young people thinking the correct way about their place in society and what they should be valuing and how they should be supporting the Communist Party.
Yes, very much a direct result of Tiananmen in 1989. Another aspect of it is the introduction of Junshun, which is the compulsory, generally week or fortnight of military drills and practice, which comes at the beginning of high school and then again at the beginning of university, again directly because of Tiananmen, to try and instill a sense of, well, obedience in the young generations. And a third upshot of this broad campaign, which I think has rather gotten out of control, is anti-Japanese sentiment, which was drummed up by the propaganda department, now called the publicity department, and has created a generation of young Chinese, many of whom have very xenophobic notions, and on a couple of occasions in 2005 and 2012 have gone out on the streets and smashed up Toyota cars driven by Chinese and ramen shops and other Japanese businesses because of this vehement anti-Japanese sentiment. So it's an immensely complicated picture in a generation of 320 million people in their teens and 20s, which after all is the population of the United States. And there's no generalization to be given except for that diversity that they encompass, which is a new thing. A relatively new thing in China. And demographically, at least, this generation is the group of people to whom the century belongs, perhaps purely by force of numbers. There are a lot of young Chinese who will spend most of their lives in this century and have an amazingly important impact on it. So what they're thinking and what their values and attitudes are is going to be very decisive for the direction of this century, which is why it's important to unpick all of the different aspects which can coexist at the same time. You could be both nationalistic and also socially liberal, which I think is broadly true of many, many young Chinese.
So with both your Chinese friends and the subjects in your book, the six people you focus on in your book who probably have become friends as well, do you hear as they're thinking about the future, their own personal futures to begin with, in this age when things have become a little tighter, are they nonetheless optimistic on balance? Or do they feel like, you know, I really have no idea, I'm just trying to make it work as I go forward?
I'm consistently struck and impressed by the drive and the ambition of young Chinese. Certainly those around me in Beijing and also those from elsewhere in the countryside. And a sense of agency over your own life. Because from a very young age, there's very little else to rely on except your own the belief that if you achieve academically or in the business world, you can realize your own Chinese dream. Which, of course, when Xi Jinping used that phrase shortly after he came into power in 2012 and the beginning of 2013, he first used this phrase within the context of the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. His conception of the Chinese dream is everyone getting together behind the party as China becomes the great strong power in the world and economically. But what I've seen much more at the ground level and other observers have noticed as well is that the population of China seems to have run with the notion of the Chinese dream more along lines of the American dream, which is individual dreams, individual ambitions. How can I transform my own life? Well, Xi Jinping comes from an era of the collective. And we know this because he comes from a red family, as we call it. His father was a revolutionary hero, and he is a true believer in socialism. Every indication shows that. Whereas for this generation that I write about and the China around me, it's more about the individual than the collective. It's about me, not about we. A lot more of them. How can I change my life? Or how can I get out of China? And a lot less of a collective ambition for how can I change China? How can I get involved, become an activist, join civil society, or even start a company just for the social good that it can create? I see a little bit of that. There's a strong, pretty strong volunteer culture. Young people will be idealists everywhere in the world. But there certainly seems to be a stronger belief that you can change your own life than a belief that you can change China around you. And unfortunately, I think they're probably right. I think that that question of what are we really looking for to give meaning to our lives is probably the most important question which will define China in the next decades and this generation as they grow up. Because in many respects, China has done what it set out to do when it first started to walk that very different road in the early 80s, the road of capitalism, of state capitalism, development, getting rich. To many respects, it's done that. Of course, it has a long way to go, and per capita GDP is still very low. It's absolutely a developing country. But for many people in the cities, in this burgeoning middle class, and for many young people who already have a lot of the opportunities which those young people 20 years ago would not have had, the question is not now, how can I get rich? The question is, what now? And that's the big question for China as well. What now? What do we do now that we are becoming a rich country and a powerful country? This is why a lot of young people have embraced Buddhism, urban Buddhism, or embraced individual endeavors like opening a cafe over the traditional iron rice bowl paths of joining a bank or a state-owned enterprise and having a stable job, which their parents very much encouraged them to do. That's another example of the generation gap. I think a lot of people ask, what can give my life meaning and purpose now? What's the direction I want to choose for myself? And at the higher level, that's the question I think China will have to ask itself as well as it transitions from a poor country where the priority is clear to a growing country with greater responsibilities on the world stage, which will have to ask more questions than just, how do I get rich?
It seems like there are a lot of somewhat contradictory things going on here. And indeed, there are a lot of contradictory things going on here. So China wants to be, when I say China, I mean the Chinese leadership, the political leadership, want to be seen globally as being a leader. They want global respect. They want the kind of soft power that the United States has long enjoyed. But they have been reluctant to sort of step up and play the role that the U.S. has played in terms of giving aid or in terms of getting involved in thorny negotiations in regions where China has interests. That's one level of contradictions. The other that you've touched on in what you've been saying is you've got this generation of young people who are kind of more focused on what's my life going to be about? You know, what's important to me? Where is my center of meaning? And also a growing amount of nationalism. It's almost like, okay, you government, take care of that part. You know, we want China to be great in the world, but I just don't want to put a lot of effort into having to think about that.
I think you've correctly identified the contradictory nature of any big discussion about China. And to live here and to be young and Chinese here, you have to be comfortable in that state of cognitive dissonance and the various different self-contradictory opinions that one might hold, both liberal and nationalistic. So to identify the key direction can be quite difficult in the middle of that. But with a long view, I do tend to think that the current political climate, it's a function of Xi Jinping's generation, who grew up in the Cultural Revolution, and they have never really wanted China to be a world leader, I don't think. They just wanted it to have respect on the world stage. This is the generation influenced by the century and a half of humiliation. But however much that history is taught in schools today, I don't think that the young Chinese I write about, that it registers in the same way, because they didn't live through it. In that respect, I think there isn't that historical baggage, which can perhaps be a good thing, and it can also be a bad thing because there isn't that connection to the history or that remembrance of the history, which can help us to avoid repeating it. So in terms of whether China will step up to the plate or take a more responsible global role, given that other superpowers seem to be abdicating that role or or there are forces of decline and change in the world order, I think the top level of Chinese leadership ultimately isn't really interested in taking on the role that America played in the 20th century. I think for Xi Jinping, it's all about respect for China, growth of China under the control of the party. But in 20 years' time, in 30 years' time, when young Chinese grow up and filter up through the political system, I think they will have a very different kind of baggage and a very different environment that has formed them, and an environment in which China is at the table. And perhaps that they will carry that forward in terms of China's policy. So the key question that this, that your podcast perhaps asks, is whose will this century be, right? And if, as some people say, China will rule the world, the question is who will rule China? And it's not going to be the generation currently in power. It's going to be the next one, which is many, many generation gaps on.
Do you think China will rule the world?
I don't. As someone who lives in China and has been here for 7 or 8 years, the view from the inside is this is a developing country. It really is. And a developing country which is really struggling and making some right decisions and a lot of wrong ones. And ultimately a single party power which is prioritizing its own survival over anything else. And I can't, when I walk down the street and I see shops being torn up and everything being still constructed with that constant white noise of construction that you have in any Chinese city, and I follow the news and I see the approach to social change that the party espouses, which is prevent it, I can't imagine this being the dominant power in the 21st century. But when I talk to people my age, and I see how thoughtful they are, and for many of the very well-educated ones, how clued in and informed they are, I can imagine them being the ones who take China in a different direction. So perhaps I'll revise my answer. I'll say that I can imagine China being a dominant power in the 21st century, but I think everyone should just chill out and give it a lot more time than people seem to be giving China. I notice this when I go back home, this sense that China is suddenly coming to the forefront. And I just want to say, whoa, whoa, just give it another 20, 30 years, because there's a long way yet to go.
Do you have one or two, I mean, you've probably been doing a lot of book talks. Do you have one or two short passages that you would like to read?
So in the book, I follow the lives of six people, three boys, three girls, from all over China. This aspiring superstar, Lucifer. There's a country migrant from one of China's poorest regions who gets addicted to online gaming. There's a woman from Xinjiang, a boy who grows up in a military compound. But to me, one of the stories which resonated closest to my own interests was that of Fred. That's a she. She's the daughter of an official, what we'd call Guanardai, the official second generation in China. She was born in 1985 in Hainan province, which is a tropical island to China's south. And she studies politics at Peking University, which is where I studied my own Chinese to PhD level. And her story in the book is slightly different. It's more of an intellectual journey, which perhaps hits some of the notes of how the generation has changed as China does around it. Because Fred swings from the right, which on the Chinese political spectrum is quite liberal, free market. She swings very rapidly to the left, which is, in Chinese terms, very much pro-state involvement in economics and in politics. She becomes very nationalistic, but then moves back towards the middle by the end. And that's perhaps the position where I feel a lot of young Chinese are, and where we're not just talking about China, a lot of young people end up in the middle and compromise on early idealism politically. So I'll read just a couple of short paragraphs at the very end of Fred's narrative, which encapsulate kind of where she arrives at, where I left her story off in terms of her political opinions. As to the system itself, Leninist capitalism and single party rule, she might have shrugged her shoulders, paraphrased Winston Churchill, and said that it was the worst form of government for China except for all the others. It wasn't just a matter of her family's stake in the party's survival. It was about her own stake in the nation's future. There were such monumental challenges ahead. A slowing economy, regional instability, a demographic crunch as a generation of workers retired and the supply of cheap labour ran out. In her eyes, the leadership, for all its flaws, was still negotiating those challenges and avoiding the frankly terrifying alternative of a power vacuum. It was corrupt and messy and had skewed priorities, but the nation was still taking two steps forward for every step back. As Deng Xiaoping said, they would cross the river by feeling for the stones. The metaphor applied to her own life too. She hated the patina of smog that choked Beijing and thought about returning to Hainan or even of moving with her boyfriend to Taiwan. At the end of 2014, he proposed, or rather suggested that their parents meet before he and she got formally engaged, which was the traditional way of doing it. They set a date the following spring for their engagement, at least she wouldn't have to act surprised, and another in the autumn for the marriage. At 29 years old, Fred thought of her future as she did her nation's. There should be goals but no fixed plans, as the only constant was change. Principles, but not dogma. The best course was whatever worked to keep getting richer, stronger, better. The teenage growth spurt and formative 20s were over. Now it was time to be responsible and find a role in the world. It would take a while yet, and there would be tough times to weather, like the long Beijing winter ahead of her. But she could be patient and wait for spring.
That lovely passage. In terms of China finding its role in the world, when you talked with the main characters in your book, but also with other Chinese friends, what do you think they would like China's role to be in the world? I know you said, like, at this point, you don't see China playing the role the United States has played, that China would like to have respect. But beyond that, is there any more specificity in terms of how people, what their wish lanterns say about what they would like China to be like by the time they have grandchildren?
If I went and posed that exact question to them right now, a lot of them would say, I didn't even consider that China could have a role in the world. I think there's a lot of internal reforms that they would like to see happen in China. For Fred, she is a supporter of the state, but she wants more free speech. She wants less internet control. She wants the government to do more about environmental pollution and air pollution. For her and a lot of the other people I write about, there are so many problems facing them internally that none of them were talking of their hopes for China in international terms, of how China can play a role in Syria or even global climate change. The focus was always on either my life or China's own internal problems. So I don't think they're there quite yet. I certainly hope that for the generation to follow them, there is maybe more of a consciousness that China can play a decisive role on the world stage and be a positive force and espouse some of their own individual values.
But you're saying you personally in conversation didn't hear them say anything about... Did that surprise you?
Well, I don't know how many people in their early 20s would articulate this idea of what role their country should play in the world. And I think the view from inside China is very different from the view outside it. And I think from inside China, there isn't that idea that this century can be China's century. I think there's a pleasure derived in and a confidence derived in China being stronger economically and militarily and more important regionally, and a pleasure derived from the respect Xi Jinping gets around the world. But I'm not sure that that's the same as thinking that China can legitimately be a superpower. In some respects, I feel that the generation that I wrote about and that you wrote about when you were here, I've already been superseded maybe by the next generation, the next young generation to come along, who perhaps are more keen to see China project its power overseas, potentially. And nationalism might be one function of that.
Isn't the whole China dream thing that Xi Jinping has put forth in Rejuvenation, isn't that about
China being a global leader?
Again, I think it's about China getting respect from the world, but I'm not sure that Xi Jinping legitimately wants China to project its power very far overseas beyond economic power and the advantages that reaps for China. I think it's important to remember that Chinese politics is very factional, and there will be different people within the system who want different things for China's role in the world. And if only we had a direct line into Xi Jinping's mind. But I suspect that for all of China's boosted investment in international peacekeeping operations and boosted investment overseas, I suspect that because of where he individually has come from, the goal is the rejuvenation of China's own strength, China, not a role for China in this century that was similar to what America's role was and continues to be. What I think the key question is, if that's right, is in 20 years' time, in 30 years' time, what do the new generation of Chinese leaders think? Those are the people who I've been writing about, and the people who are, you know, in middle school now, and the people who are in middle school overseas, which is, I think, a very important point, that there are only more and more Chinese going for their education abroad, and how will that change their view of countries' responsibilities in the world? With that, if we're talking about trends, I would venture one more generalization in how the generation has evolved, which is perhaps a controversial statement, but I think it's getting more liberal as China's politics very clearly is getting more illiberal and more regressive. I would even say that that movement's towards a political regression and clamping down at the top is a direct reaction to a liberalizing society and a liberalizing youth. Women's rights is a good litmus test here, as is LGBT rights. And just last year, a gay marriage case was heard in court, shut down, of course. But the fact that it made it to court is telling. And there are more active feminist voices. There are more students overseas who I think inevitably have to engage with the rest of the world, and that does have a knock-on effect when they come back home. 330,000 of them now in the United States, huge amount of people. And voices continue to be shared online, despite attempts to shut them down. And I think in general, perhaps to put it most simply, the cat is out of the bag. I don't think China, for all that it's trying, is able to shut down all influence of ideas. However much the education ministry bans Western textbooks in universities, or however much Xi Jinping stresses a socialist core of education or any other aspects, I do think that China is part of the world now, and as this generation grows up, we'll only see more engagement with the world from them, and I hope in a positive way.
I certainly second that, though personally, I think Xi Jinping is very much interested in China having as much influence as possible in the world, that he wants this to be China's century. That doesn't mean it will happen, but China's leaders are trying. With their new Silk Road project, a trillion-dollar infrastructure-building endeavor to make China the economic hub of Asia and beyond, and by improving education, healthcare, and infrastructure within China itself, something some American political leaders might learn from. As Chinese self-made billionaire Jack Ma said at the 2017 World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Jack Ma is, of course, the founder of the e-commerce juggernaut Alibaba.
Past 30 years, the American had 13 wars, spending $14.2 trillion. The money going there. What if they spend a part of that money on building up the infrastructure, helping the white collars and blue collars? No matter how strategy good it is, you're supposed to spend money on your own people.
So he says, don't blame China and Mexico.
It's not the other countries steal jobs from you guys. It is your strategy.
Okay,
but you do not distribute the money, the money and things in a proper way.
Of course, China's got its issues too. But it's been interesting to see Xi Jinping sound downright statesmanlike on climate change and global trade, while Donald Trump makes threats, exits trade and climate change agreements, and loses friends abroad while pushing for cuts in social spending at home. Whose century will it be? I don't know. But I'm guessing not those who choose to turn inward. not those who think the 0.1% can indefinitely hoard wealth and benefits with no blowback. It's also worth remembering that history doesn't always move in a linear fashion. Time and again over human history, eras of openness have been followed by turning inward. Advanced civilizations have either self-destructed or been laid low by invaders. The world is entirely capable of changing in unexpected ways. Thanks for listening to this episode and to the Whose Century Is It podcast. I'm grateful to the Henry Luce Foundation for its support over the past 2 years in the form of a grant, and to my co-producers at Public Radio International and PRI's The World, especially The World's executive producer, Andrew Sussman, editor and reporter at The World, Jeb Sharp, who's worked with me to get segments related to this podcast on the show, and to PRI's online editor, Jonathan Keeling. So again, this is the last episode I'll be doing as part of the Luce-funded grant and as a co-production with PRI's The World. The archive of all 52 episodes, plus print versions, photos, and links, will remain on the webpage pri.org/century. I will be continuing the podcast, same theme, same approach, coming out the first week of each month, still available on iTunes and wherever else you get your podcasts. Subscribe if you haven't already, so you won't miss an episode. I'm also putting together a new Whose Century Is It website and Facebook page. More on where to find those in the next episode. And that leaves me to say, this 2-year season of Whose Century Is It has been a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's been funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Whose Century Is It now starts its own new future. Keep listening.